Hey friend, welcome to the Mamahood After Trauma podcast. I'm your host, Emily Cleghorn. This podcast is for mamas navigating childhood trauma while also walking through mamahood. I'm so excited that you've decided to take some time out of your day to join me and tune in. I hope you find this podcast uplifting and empowering. Let's get to it. Hey there. Before we jump into this episode, I want to let you know about something that is brand new that you have access to as a Mamahood After Trauma listener. Now, tell me, does this sound like you? You want to give your littles a positive childhood experience. You want the steps to finally heal your childhood trauma. You're tired of the fear holding you back in life, and you enjoy being a mama, and you want to be more present. If you answered yes to any of the above, I would invite you to check out the Mama Untriggered private podcast series. This is a 5-part private podcast series that teaches you how to ditch the emotional roller coaster and bust out of the fear controlling your mamahood. Let's teach you how to calm your nervous system through small, simple steps. I mean, parenting books and workshops are great, but we believe it's better to give you short, actionable audio clips that allow you to take action right away so that they can't escape from your mom brain, right? If this sounds at all interesting to you, I would invite you to head over to subscribepage.io/mamauntriggered. That's subscribepage.io/mamauntriggered. Now, let's go into this episode of the Mamahood After Trauma podcast. Hello, hello, friends, and welcome to this episode of the Mamahood After Trauma podcast. I am so excited that you have taken some time out of your day to tune in and listen to this conversation. Today, we are having a conversation with Kara. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. And the topic that we are diving into today is one that I'm betting our listeners have not heard a lot of. So today we're talking about therapy resistance. So maybe let's start off with you introducing where you became familiar with therapy resistance.
Well, I was one. I was my first therapy resistant person that I had met and was doing all the right things, was going to therapy, was doing the medication, was doing quotes, air quotes, all the right things. And I began to get to the end of all of my ropes, every single idea, every single new thing that I would try, you know, to solve the internal question, what's wrong with me? Mm-hmm. And I realized none of them were working. So I really began to either dig my heels into the concept and belief there is something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
And that paired with the idea that whatever is out there will not work on me because there is something inherently wrong with me that this will not be able to reach. So I was my first one. And fortunately, fast forward 6 or 7 years now, I've met many people that are that same way, that overturned, they would say, all of the stones that they could in their life to come up empty. And that is what my practices and courses and teachings all base around for the people that tried it all.
Yeah, so I resonate so much with what you just said. You turn over every stone thinking, okay, this thing is going to help me. This thing is going to help me. And then as time passes and you do, quote unquote, all the right things, and it doesn't help. Mm-hmm. So let's break it down really simply. What is therapy resistance?
Therapy resistance, I like to define it simply and take a complex concept and put it into the finest possible point that I can say. Therapy resistance is basically a person's dependency on outer help, outer resources, as opposed to their own. And such a dependency that almost negates any sense of self-foundation, self-referencing, self-certainty. There's just none. When you ask them how they feel, when you ask them what's wrong, when you ask them what they want, they don't have a fine point answer to it. They can tell you what they don't want. Mm-hmm. They can tell you what they're afraid of. They can tell you why it's like this. They can go right into the story, but you ask them a pointed question, something that would require them to self-reference, and there's next to no ability to do that. They don't stand even on the ground on their own 2 feet directly underneath them. And so they will seek the friendship advice. They'll call the sister in an emergency. They'll book a therapy appointment because they're not feeling well, or they'll go straight for the bottle, or they'll go straight for the pills, or they'll go straight for the RSVP, or straight for the dating app, or straight because they need their sense of certainty, their sense of recovery, to come from an external source of emotion.
Oh man. And that is almost the definition experience of a childhood trauma survivor.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so we know what it is now. How do we overcome it?
That's a long-winded question and answer because there are nuances for everyone. But the cool thing is, at the end of the day, it is about building the self-fulfillment and their ability to now own themselves, to on that authenticity of the nervous system sends a signal. Mm-hmm. And I listen to it as opposed to stuffing it. And that for childhood trauma people, this is not a practice that we got told at 5 or 7 or 9 or 3 that system, that feeling is wrong, mm-hmm. that want is wrong, that emotion is wrong, that behavior is wrong, that word is wrong, that stance is wrong, that eye contact is wrong, everything is wrong.
So you are wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Been debased from their formative years on repeat. And now the thing is, they're their own abuser. They don't have the father, the brooding father. They don't have the malicious uncle. They don't have the narcissistic mother, the consuming family member that debases them constantly. They've done it so many times on loop and repeat. They get the information and they now do the job of their abuser for them.
Mm-hmm.
So to reverse this process, simply put, no matter what methods are required, simply put, you have to rebase them, learn to adhere and acknowledge and accept and then adjust to whatever signals their body is telling them instead of avoiding, distracting, or numbing just to try and push it away.
Yes. Yes. So where did you start when you recognized that you were therapy resistant? What were some of the first steps, maybe the first step that you took on your journey?
After talking myself out of suicide, to be honest, I had a moment in a bathtub where I was listening to Dr. Wayne Dyer give a lecture, and he was talking about just the all permissible quality to our existence. Mm-hmm. That everything goes, that everything we are goes, that everything we experience goes, that our limitless soul did choose to be here, did choose our parents, did choose our experiences, did choose to explore the depths of all of it. Everything was permissible, which means our bliss and our agony, our love and our abuse, our, like, there is an intrinsic, eternal part of us that does not look at our trauma and hold back from it. Mm-hmm. It counts the quality of the experience possible within that story. And I personally believe that our, you know, energy cannot be created nor destroyed. So when we pass on, I personally believe, now this could rub a lot of people wrong, that we will gather back up to universe or source or God or whatever you want to call it. And then we decide another time where we come back down and re-inhabit another human experience in some capacity or another. And that could be way baseless. My personal belief is I think that there are old souls. There's people that have done this 1,000 times. You can kind of just read it in their face. I'm like, you've done this, but you've done life before, even if it's a little kid. Like, you're just an old soul. And in that moment, when Wayne was speaking, I realized that in some capacity, the low that I was experiencing was an invitation, was a catalyst, and that I could either ignore it again and again and again and again, or I could peel open this unknown pathway, this place that I had never gone, of taking total ownership. And what if all of this was truly happening for me, for a purpose? What if this is an entirely new crosswalk where I could just split path and go off into the wilderness instead of staying on this story? Mm-hmm. And when he was talking about that, that's when I realized the power of our own story. Trauma wasn't what happened to me. Trauma wasn't necessarily, there are people that in other countries, it's totally normal for a three-year-old's genitals to be mutilated. It's normal. So the child isn't traumatized. They know that that is the age where something horrible happens to them, but they don't view it as horrible because now they're like, I'm a big boy now. Now I have this, now I'm a man like my dad. But if we were to do that in this country, we would be running for the, like, just send them to prison, death row for instantly. But it's a cultural definition that translates by each individual of how they will translate that experience. Mm-hmm. So my being beaten by a dad or experiencing my mother being thrown down a hallway or watching violent crimes happen in my neighborhood or having repressed memories from thinking that I've suffered from sexual abuse, even though I can't recall it. It's like that to another culture, another person, another age group, another whatever may not view it that same way. And if I don't, am I not guaranteed to experience trauma? If it's not a guarantee that something violent happens to you and you don't necessarily all experience trauma, then that debunks, that makes it baseless that all violent offenses, all sexual offenses, all traumatic experiences are actually traumatic. I have the power and the ability to define that in my story, to frame it. A divorce can be the best and worst thing to ever happen to you. Losing a job can be the best or worst thing to ever happen to you. Mm-hmm. Somebody losing their job could be traumatic if they choose to frame it into a story that now victimizes them. Mm-hmm. And the same is true for the opposite. You can, and so if that's the case, then this divorce or this trauma or this loss of job or loss of life or diagnosis, if I can choose a path, then I'm not automatically traumatized. I'm not automatically a victim. So therefore, I can automatically be owning a hero in my own story. I can be in charge of which path to go down. And in that moment in the bathtub, I decided, I'm just going to play with this. I'm just going to choose, what if this were the greatest thing to happen to me? Who would I become? How would I show up? how would I get out of this bathtub and change my lifestyle, my home, my appearance, my health, my how I show up in my relationships, how I show up at work. If this were to be the greatest thing ever and I'm no longer a victim, what would it look like? I just got real curious, almost gaslit myself for a while of like, how else could this look? And the wildest possible 5 years followed that I cannot even overstate how different that one shift was. And I think that's what people look for in therapy is those aha, click, clear moments. But I had one sitting in an existential crisis in a cold bathtub, no therapy, no medication, no nothing, just click. And it just broke open.
Yeah. Your trauma is not the event that happened to you. It is your interpretation and how you view it in your mind. And that is a huge realization. I remember when I made that realization, it didn't result in quite a big, as big of a light bulb moment as you just described, but it's empowering to realize that, okay, so I have the power to shift things. That you've left me speechless.
Well, I love, you can almost see people playing with that idea when you talk to them about it. Mm-hmm. You can see the light bulb moment. You can see them questioning. And when you get them to ask that first question, it's amazing because the punctuation is what screws them. This is the worst thing to ever happen to me. It's like our language. When you say that, this is the worst thing to ever happen to me, who do you become when you believe that thought? Who do you have to be in order to have said that? And then, therefore, what are your thoughts, feelings, actions, behaviors, identities attached to this is the worst thing that's ever going to happen to me? You can take the same person, same scenario, same situation and say, this is the best thing that's ever going to happen to me. And there's two very different paths for each of those people. And I think there's not enough people understand that decision does not require anything out there. That that decision can be made in a moment. I'm in any situation, we always get to decide three things in every single moment. What is it? What am I going to focus on? So therefore, what part of this dynamic, what am I going to extract from that as fact? Then what am I going to make it mean? So I've taken my fact, I've taken my core truth, the core statement. This is I've lost my job. This is the worst thing to ever happen to me. What does it mean? My life is over. I'm screwed. I don't know what to do. Now I'm surviving. And then what are you going to do about it? Well, if I'm surviving, now I'm looking for, if it's a job, I'm not looking for contract jobs. I'm getting skinny in my budget. I'm not maybe eating as well. I'm buying the cheap stuff. I have this idea that I have to withhold, and now I have to contract, and now I have to survive. That's a very different thing than somebody who goes, I lost my job. What does it mean? This could be the best thing to ever happen to me. Okay, mm-hmm. That's what it means. What am I going to do about it? This could be the best thing to ever. I am unlimited now. I am completely my days are mine. I'm going to take a few days. I'm going to decide what this means. I'm going to decide where to go from here. I'm going to meet. What have I always wanted to do? Let's take in some ideas. Let's see if my friends have anything, any work that they've been, or a position or a company or a project or something that we can collaborate on, or maybe it's time to open that business. Those two tracks came from the same external event that we all put our power in.
Mm-hmm.
The same event. The decision occurs within the person. And I wish that more people understood the irrevocable power that they have. That decision occurs no matter what happens out there. No matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had that, I think we'd put all of these mega industries, you know, even the beauty industry, the therapy industry, like we would put them all, we would have people that are healthy. We would not have people addicted to refined sugars and caffeine and drugs and alcohol and beauty products and God knows what else, because they would just, oh, well, means what I say it means. It is what it is, but it means what I say it means. All across the board.
Yeah. So tying this back to motherhood and motherhood after trauma, when I first became a mom, like fresh postpartum, and I was sitting on my couch looking down at my daughter thinking, okay, so now I'm either going to repeat the cycle and become my mother, or I'm going to choose another path. And that decision, that moment, I think if we want to look at it, it was my bathtub moment. Because we have a choice. We have a choice as to how we're going to show up as mothers, how we're going to parent our children. Because yeah, we've had this example. Maybe it was a terrible one. But if you don't want to go down that path, you have the power to choose the other path.
100%. And I won't even. Okay, there is a light pole in the middle of Alaska. It's on a 90 degree turn, and it is the most crashed into light pole that it shows where the curve in the road is, but it is the most crashed into light pole because it's at the bottom of a hill. And the reason why it's the most crashed into pole ever is because what do you think people are trying not to hit when they're realizing they're slipping out of control on this curve or they're going too fast or whatever? They don't want to hit the pole. So they hit the pole. Why? Because it's what they're focusing on.
Mm-hmm.
What they're focusing on. Whether or not, like, I don't want to hit the pole. I don't want to hit the pole. I don't want to hit the pole. Well, where's your focus? The pole. I had the same realization with, I was like, I want to be anything other than my mother. Mm-hmm. I don't care what kind of mom I am. I just do not want to be my mother. That's all. I had one goal and one goal only. I don't want to be my parents, and I definitely don't want to be my mother. And so through my first child, I was to a fine point. I laughed like her. I disciplined her like her. I yelled at her. I manipulated like her. I did everything exactly like her. No exceptions. And I'll never forget the day I walked into my son had another accident. He was probably 2.5 years old. And I walked fast toward him in his bathroom, and he cowered away from me. My skin just got like crawls, like all the crawlies. And I remember like, oh my God, my son is afraid of me. I wanted to die. Like I would, if God could have just struck me dead right in that moment, I would have been like, thank you for sparing me from that. Because it was the most guttural, gross feeling ever. My insides just went to instant sewage. And I walked out of the room. I have become my mother, that realization. And then again, another bathtub moment where it's like, okay, what am I going to focus on? And in that moment, it was a blaring, huge red lit invitation. Okay, what? I don't want to be my mom. I have become my mom because I don't want to be here. So now you have this, I had to scrap that completely. What kind of mother do I want to be?
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was so uncomfortable, the idea of going in there after having that power and authoritarian, you know, demonstratively consuming mother energy, I had to go in there with compassion. Mm-hmm. I had to go in there and just humble myself to pieces and tell him, that was wrong. I'm sorry I scared you. Do you forgive me? And just instead of being the almighty totalitarian, everything's right, you're wrong, I'm infallible. And from that day forward, he was 2 and a half, I think 3 maybe. And he's 18 now. And he hears one thing over and over and over from his mom. I'm going to screw up. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm figuring it out. We grew up together.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want you to ever think that you can't talk to me, come to me, tell me, talk to me. It's always going to be how you say it, but mm-hmm. I want you to be able to say anything. And we have had powerful conversations where he is allowed to speak fully and endlessly. He is a steward of his own life. I am just here to steward him along. And he's not my property. He's not my punching bag. He's not my, just even just the whipping boy for all of my emotional drainage. A lot of moms, they tell their kids all their problems. It's like, you don't have to keep it all in, but do not, if your kids are getting wet from your emotionally dysfunctional ocean, you're getting them too involved. Those moments, those bathtub moments, those invitations, those breaks in the clouds, those maybe not, maybe the question mark starts to appear where a period used to be, take the question mark every single time. If evolution and change always comes from good. You, when you see a question mark pop up, like, hey, I don't like this. What else could this mean? What else could I do? What else could I have? What else could I be? What other way could I show up here? Take the question mark, take the question mark, take the question mark, take the question mark. They're beautiful moments. I'll, 3 kids later, and I have successfully not become my mother. And life's gotten damn cool, but the road that I initially took was definitely all about the pole that I didn't want to hit. And then inevitably every single time ending up in a head-on collision with said pole.
Yeah, you focus on not hitting the pole, you're gonna hit the pole. For me, I focused on, okay, so I don't want to be that. What's the opposite of that?
Yes. I did that too.
I was gaslit and told I was wrong. Okay, so the opposite of that is listening and compassion. I was never apologized to, so let's apologize, because they're people and they have feelings too. Their feelings are very developmental, but they're coming. And so that's been my journey. Mind you, motherhood was incredibly triggering. So that was my journey, navigating that.
Yeah.
Where can our listeners connect with you further if they would like to do so?
I'm pretty much ever present. I wanted to be something that was very accessible, whether people needed something free or a support system and community. Googling Kara Payton would probably be the best way, because if they're an Instagram person, I'm there. If they're a YouTube person, I'm there. If they want to go to the website and get a free meditation, that's there. So it's like kind of a little bit of everywhere. I know that's not the most fine point. I do find myself on Instagram personally with the phone in front of me the most often, but I'm pretty easy to reach.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Kara, for joining me on the show today. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks, Emily.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to tune in to this episode of the Mamahood After Trauma podcast. If you would like more of the Mamahood After Trauma community, make sure to look in the description of this episode for the link to become a Mamahood After Trauma Inner Circle member. Until next time, Mama, keep